Michel Josudevsky is an economic teacher at Ottawa University, and he will be speaking about the FTAA, free trade or political hegemony. So we'll all of them do the introduction.
We are at a historical juncture because just yesterday, Quebec Superior Court has ruled on an injunction, and the ruling is to the effect that there has been or there is a violation of the Constitution, but under the circumstances, it's all right because of the situation in which we are, and therefore the wall remains. So we're talking about the Quebec Wall. Now, I'd like to, first of all, give you some details about the security operation. Although a lot of this material is already well documented, we are certainly facing the most important security operation directed against civilians in North American history. $46 million have been allocated to the expenses of building the wall and bringing in troops from Nova Scotia, 1,200 troops, and that doesn't include all the FBI and CIA agents which are roaming the city. Incidentally, they have said they're going to do better than in Seattle. We will recall that in Seattle, what was used was essentially the militarized components of the police force, the anti-riot gang squads and SWAT teams. We are going to have a much more sophisticated police operation in this city than has ever been undertaken in North America. According to an RCMP spokesperson, the 6,000 police and security forces on hand are not only equipped with pepper spray, but with the multi-shot Arwen 37 guns, which shoot hard-coated plastic bullets. And I quote from RCMP spokesperson, which says that these plastic bullets, quote, are meant to crack a rib and put them in a lot of pain. Tactical squads are usually required to test such less lethal weapons, such as tasers, which deliver electric shocks on themselves, on the police. But Toronto Police Constable Layton, I guess he's somewhere around, said that it would be too dangerous to do that with the Arwen. And in addition to that, we now know that the Canadian Armed Forces from Nova Scotia have rushed in 1,200 military personnel. What is behind this massive police operation? What is the hidden agenda of this summit? I think we have to understand that this is not a trade deal. Okay? This is not a trade deal. In fact, the trade rep for the United States, Mr. Robert Zelnick, is a member of the national security team, very close to Colin Powell's Condoleezza Rice. He was in the national security team in the first Bush administration of Papa. Let us call free trade by its name. This is the American Empire. And those who are negotiating the American Empire behind closed doors are very much linked up to the national security apparatus of the United States. This free trade, so-called free trade agreement, redefines fundamental social relations. It defines a whole social existence of sovereign nations. It is accompanied by the militarization of South America through the Plan Colombia, but it also, in a sense, enshrines certain fundamental changes into a set of legally binding documents, which are then entrenched in international law. The basic and fundamental mechanism behind this free trade, so-called free trade agreement, or one of them, is the so-called clause on national treatment, What this clause on national treatment implies is that you must give the same rights to a foreign investor as to a local investor. But when you define investment in an all-encompassing fashion to include everything from the financing of Boy Scouts to daycare centers to sports clubs to municipal activities, what do you have? What is the end result of that process? It is the transformation of all those social activities, namely those of the welfare state, into profit-making undertakings. In other words, it is the disappearance and the dismantling of an entire institutional structure. With regard to cities, bear in mind, very important, with regard to cities, what will happen? The same mechanism. We're now living in Quebec under this famous Law 170. In Ontario and other parts of the continent, other processes are ongoing. What do they want to do under Law 170? The basic and fundamental mechanism behind the free trade agreement is the deregulation and ultimately the privatization of all social services right down to the municipalities. That means that municipalities do not exist anymore. It would be similar to what we have, what exists in the United States. You might see them in California and Arizona, the so-called gated communities. They wouldn't be gated, but they would be controlled by private corporations, the highways, the inner urban space, the institutions, the school boards would be run by private companies. Bill Gates would set up a network of contracts with schools right through the hemisphere with, you know, with video cameras and so on. In other words, it is the privatization of the welfare state. In Latin America, the IMF structural adjustment program has led to devastating economic and social consequences. It is under the jurisdiction of the IMF. We are living in Canada, also a form of structural adjustment, but it is managed and implemented otherwise. It's still under the dominion of creditors. In Quebec, it's under the déficit zéro. It consists in destroying social programs. But in Latin America, it has been, of course, much more devastating. And these IMF reforms are imposed in the context of the renegotiation of debt. They are, in other words, they are based on what is called loan agreements. Now, these loan agreements, you sign with the IMF, and the IMF says, you do this, you do that, you close down the schools, privatize, deregulate agriculture, open up your borders, push the interest rates up to 550%. That's what happened to Turkey a few weeks ago. 550%. And the currency collapsed by 45%. Standard of living is cut in half. Now, what happens under the free trade agreement? Under the free trade agreement, IMF medicine becomes permanent. It becomes enshrined. It is not subject to an ad hoc agreement or negotiation with creditors. You understand what that means? In other words, what happens, people from Latin America will understand. You negotiate on an ad hoc basis with the IMF. They set conditions. You can always say, no, we won't do it, and then they cut off the disbursements. But what the FTAA rule will say is that IMF medicine is compulsory, whether you receive money or not. It doesn't matter. You have to follow IMF medicine. In other words, it becomes entrenched. It becomes enshrined. Countries presently are bonded to their creditors, but they are not enslaved in terms of permanent articles entrenched in international law. That is the fundamental difference. Okay? So that the Latin American countries and our friends from Latin America who are coming and debating, they understand this. They have lived this experience of IMF reforms the last 20 years and the devastation that this has brought. And what is now at stake is to make that medicine absolutely mandatory, irrespective of negotiations. You wouldn't get any money for it, okay? You go to your creditor and say, I want to have a loan, the IMF will say, well, listen, we're not in charge of policy reform anymore. You have to do it irrespective of whether you get the money or not. So that here we have a different level of enforcement. Okay? Dollarization is not officially part of these meetings. But dollarization, when I say dollarization, it means the adoption of the US dollar as the currency for all 34 countries. Okay? That is what it means. And it has some very important implications because it really means the loss of sovereignty. Total loss of sovereignty. Why? Because the control over monetary policy is the key to any kind of social project. Okay? If you create money and credit, that is the basis for financing public programs. It's the basis for subsidizing municipalities. It's the basis for supporting agriculture, which they're not doing, incidentally. I mean, we're already in that phase of a Bank of Canada, which is in decay. But that is the function of monetary policy. And when that sovereignty is taken away and replaced by the Federal Reserve Board, which is the central banking institution in the United States, but which is not a public institution. Please understand, the Federal Reserve system is not a publicly owned bank. It is a bank which is controlled by a handful of large Wall Street banks, mainly Wall Street, but there are other banks. There are 12 branches of the Federal Reserve system. Okay? Now, what they really want to do is first deregulate the financial system altogether. Okay? No more Canadian banks, no more Mexican banks, no more Chilean banks, just good old American banks. And then, de facto, the US dollarization will proceed. Monetary policy in each of the individual countries will be wiped out. And what we'll have is the US dollar, perhaps we'll stick the Queen's picture on it. It will be at 50 cents because that's really the cutoff point. Okay? We'll have a nice, neat 50 split. Clearly, in Canada, that means the collapse of wages. It means that the country can be bought up at a discount. That means assets can be acquired. In Latin America, the situation is, of course, is far more serious because the dollarization process has already engulfed several countries, okay, including Argentina, Ecuador, El Salvador and Guatemala, okay, and many other countries and Panama, okay, many of the countries in the hemisphere may not be officially using the US dollar, but in effect, they are totally subjected to the trusteeship of the Wall Street banks. And what this implies is the formation of what we call currency boards. Currency boards don't do anything. They just print paper. They don't have any kind of monetary policy attached to it. You need full foreign exchange backing to finance a school or a hospital or whatever. That means Wall Street controls. You want to build a school in Chile, you have to go and ask George Soros to finance it. That's what it means. Militarization and dollarization are the essential building blocks of the American empire. This is not strictly an economic project. It is a strategic, geopolitical project. It involves the militarization of the continent. It integrates these different things in a very specific way. It attempts to build a consensus around some bogus. I mean, if you look at the discourse, and now they're saying, well, we're not. The discourse this morning, if you read the press, is that when you listen to the news, they say, we're going to insist on a democracy clause that any country who is not democratic will be excluded, okay? Now, I'd say Canada should go out to start, okay? Yeah. Now, I think we have to understand the complicity of the civil society organizations, the complicity And I don't want to generalize, but I mean, I think it's not complicity of the rank and file of these organizations. It's the complicity of trade union leaders, AFL-CIO, Canadian Labour Congress, FTQ, Henri Massé. The issue we have to decide upon is who is in, who is out. It's interesting that at the court hearings last week, the government spokesperson, Mr. Ricard, made some statements as to what he calls accommodating measures with a view to supporting freedom of expression. When it comes down to taking a position, the civil society organizations and the trade unions, what do? They say we want environmental clauses, we want our labor codes, we want human rights codes, we want the democracy clauses. That's what they want. And then what they will say is, we've been pressuring and lobbying, and we're on the inside, we're on the outside. Our people are on the side negotiating, our people on the outside being hit by the police, doesn't really matter. But we are trying to negotiate changes in the official documents by adding in commas. It's not going to change, it's not going to make one iota of difference whether you have a comma here or a comma there, or a clause here or a clause there on labor rights or human rights. Because the fundamental mechanisms, which I've discussed earlier, national treatment, dollarization, militarization, destruction of the welfare state, and deregulation of labor markets, etc., that is what's going to determine whether there's democracy or human rights, etc. In fact, the national security state system, the police state system, is built into their economic and social proposals, into their trade proposals, because it destroys and it also pushes, it destroys and it pushes the system against the people, the citizens. And we must understand that there is a certain ritual of dissent, the ritual of inviting civil society leaders into the inner circle of power. That's what they're doing. Now, this is nothing new. They did it in Davos, okay? If people followed what was going on in Davos, talking about Davos, the Global Business Summit, back in January, okay? You read about it in the newspapers, and then you see civil society leaders there in the counter Davos, and people are being hit by police and sprayed with water cannons, right? Now, inside, did you know that inside, I'll mention the names of the people who were inside, okay? Some of them at least. Greenpeace, Amnesty International, Save the Children, they were all there. Giorgetti, Sweeney, 59 organizations of civil society were inside Davos, mingling in a friendly environment with George Soros, Bill Gates, and World Bank President James Wolfson. Meanwhile, outside the conference center, the rank and file of these same organizations were being clobbered by the Swiss riot police. That is the rules of dissent. To quote the CEO of Greenpeace, it's either Greenpeace or Save the Children. They call it the rules of engagement. The rules of engagement. Okay, we have to work together. How do we do it? What we're dealing with in the New World Order is a ritual of inviting civil society leaders into the inner circles of power while simultaneously repressing their rank and file. And that serves some very important functions, because it first points to public opinion that the critics of globalization must make concessions. They must make concessions to earn the right to mingle with George Soros and James Wolfson. Okay? We're not going to invite you guys in if you're not going to negotiate with us some kind of deal. Secondly, it conveys the illusion that while these global elites should be subject to criticism because we're in a so-called democratic society, that nonetheless, these global elites have legitimacy, okay? We don't question their legitimacy. That is the basis. We have to question their legitimacy if we want to disarm the system. And thirdly, it says there is no alternative. Tina, there's no alternative to globalization. Fundamental changes are not possible. All you can hope for is some give and take with these rulers. And that is the kind of ritual which these power brokers of civil society are engaged in. They are brought into a dialogue. They are made comfortable. They are treated like global citizens acting on behalf of the rank and file, but when in fact they are serving the interests of global capital. And while the globalizers may take a few progressive stands to demonstrate their good intentions, they are ultimately interested in reinforcing their clutch on citizens, and they also want to divide and weaken the protest movement. And that's why we're here. These young people in Seattle, Prague, and Quebec are involved in protest because they reject the notion that money is everything, because they reject the impoverishment of millions and the destruction of fragile earth. We need to challenge the right of the globalizers to rule. We have to rethink the process of protest, and essentially, we have to get to the legitimacy of what is being negotiated. And when I say we have to get to the legitimacy, we also have to understand the inner corridors. We have to understand these mechanisms, how they function. But we also have to get into the inner corridors of how these trade deals are negotiated behind closed doors. What I'm saying is that George W. Bush's trade negotiator, Robert Zelnick, is preparing fast-track legislation packaged under what is called Presidential Trade Promotion Authority. What he wants to do is to rush the whole thing through very quickly through Congress without amendments, because the empire cannot be amended. In other words, instating the American empire through a trade deal, through dollarization, through militarization, is not going to be subjected to the uncertainties of parliamentary debate. And I guess that the Canadian, all the parliaments in Latin America, in any event, are bogus institutions. They're all going to implement some kind of fast-track legislation to get this whole thing through. Now, there are other negotiations taking place behind closed doors, and that's where these civil society guys come in. What I'm saying is that you have the Business Roundtable and the Emergency Committee for American Trade, ECAT, which is integrated by the representatives of America's largest corporations. They have the documents. They have the documents because they draft the documents, okay? Well, the documents are drafted by officials, but they're in close contact with these business groups. These are the power elites in the United States. The Business Roundtable and ECAT call the shots. But what is the agenda of the Business Roundtable? It's very important. I'll tell you what the agenda of the Business Roundtable is. They are pushing the line, the same line as the civil society organizations. Quote, to make labor and environmental standards part of future trade talks. That is what the Business Council and ECAT are doing, and they're doing it in consultation with organized labor, with the AFL-CIO. That is what is happening. So that John Sweeney gets together with the corporations, they discuss behind closed doors. It is very appealing now for the business community to present the free trade agreement in some marketable form. They want to sell it like some new model automobile. It will have a human rights body and a democracy steering wheel, and it'll be an environmentally friendly agreement. They want to insert all these labels, all the ritual inside the agreement. The unions are pushing it, okay? If you read the speeches of Henri Massé, they'll say, we're against neoliberalism, we think it's a bad system, blah, 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 blah. And I fully agree with what they're saying. The statements are well drafted by people who work for the unions, who understand that and who are sincere. But then the union bosses go, and what do they negotiate? Their usual clauses. They're putting in commas here and there in the agreement. And so that behind the closed doors, that is what's happening. And I wouldn't be surprised, I don't want to make any predictions, but you're going to have a lot of official pronouncements on the insertion of these clauses into the agreements. Democracy, environmental, women's rights, etc., specific clauses, and then some, not all, but some of our civil society organizations will then cry victory, we've done it, we've achieved global showdown, and we have won the day, okay? What they have won has already been proposed by the business roundtable, and we must be very careful that we're not dealing with an agreement which can in any way be amended. It cannot be amended, because by inserting these clauses in the agreement, essentially you provide legitimacy to the globalizers, to the onslaught of dollarization, militarization, destruction of institutions, literally wiping it out, entrenched in international law, in an all-encompassing process which destroys people's lives. And what I'm saying here is the American empire cannot be amended. It must be rejected, it must be fought, it must be defeated, and the FTA must be closed down.